morning. Nice to be here. I've always wanted to visit Victoria, so here I am. And it's not disappointing. I actually expected it to be much wetter. I thought it'd be more like England, West Sussex kind of thing. Next week? But the ground is very dry. You know, I expected it more. Anyway, it's lovely. It's lovely. And I've just come off Cortez Island. And my thoughts went, why doesn't all of Ontario live in British Columbia? What I found in Cortez, it's the flora is very beautiful, the tall trees and so on, but it's also very benign. In Ontario now we have ticks with limes, a very serious disease now, so the forests are actually quite, unfortunately, quite threatening environments. And mosquitoes, we have serious mosquitoes. Cortez has these benign mosquitoes. It's really different. And the trees and the people there, it's nice to see an island where everyone feels very privileged to be. I really feel privileged to be in this place. So, we had this lovely kayaking trip, and I've got some rotator cuff issues, and I thought it was going to be hell, but I actually fixed it. So there's a bonus. So I'm feeling very grateful, very, very grateful indeed. So today and tomorrow we have a couple of days for reflection and quietness, and each of you will have your own practices that you do and your own challenges that you're facing socially, inwardly. So I think the only thing I can really offer are sort of suggestions, things that work for me. Sort of general suggestions within which I think each of us finds a way. The thing that I have been reflecting for myself a lot on this kayaking retreat is very much based on the old issue of head and heart. And we've been pondering that for years now, haven't we? The head and the heart. And the way I've been kind of considering that, say, in terms of the head or intellect, you can look at me now, and you can look at me analytically. So you can say, ah, he just shaved his head. Or he's big, or he's small, or he's got a lovely robe, or he's wearing a brown bed sheet, or you know, whatever way you want to analyze it, you can look at me as an object and then assess that image in a critical way, not critical bad, just in a way that we do. And that's part of our possibility of human beings, and it's a necessary part. So we look and we see, oh yeah, the exit is here, and the toilet is over there, and we have time, and we have a chunk of time to meditate, and then we have lunch time, and that's all using the head, the analytical part. So there's nothing right or wrong with it. The question would be, when does it go wrong? When does that aspect of being human go wrong? And obviously it goes wrong when it's infused with some kind of ignorance, some kind of delusion, and runs into fear or self-criticism or jealousy or resentment and all that. And that's when the head is infected by something which is not skillful, not wholesome. And then the thinking mind is no longer just considering where is the toilet, when is lunchtime. The thinking mind now is being pushed and motivated by unwholesome forces and energies, and so we suffer. And the other part, the heart, say taking care of my mom, was a nine-year practice of the Brahmaviharas. You know, the Brahmaviharas in Buddhism are the kind of divine abidings, divinity being defined not as an external entity, but rather as an internal possibility. So divinity in this way is defined as the sense of what we call metta or loving kindness or inclusion. I can include things. Karuna is compassion, mudita is joy, and equanimity is upekkha. These are the four. So you have this sort of possibility in the heart of not excluding. The analytical mind excludes or differentiates or analyzes or separates. So the way I've been kind of thinking about that, let's say I go to a dentist and he does a root canal, costs me a fortune, and he gets infected and I have to do another root canal. My critical mind says, I'm not going to use that dentist again, right? That's the critical mind. The other part of me is to also include that there are bad dentists in this world, and there are failed root canals, and that being human, that's a part of life. So I include that, rather than plot a strategy to kill the dentist, or hate him forever, or get on Facebook and destroy his career, or whatever I might do. So the heart part of that is, yeah, this is a part of life. It feels this way. And the critical part of it feels this way, but I can make choices which are skillful and according to my own intelligence. And so with my mother, the opportunity to open the heart was really, really profound, because we were very good friends, we had no issues, and I really hadn't had a chance to care for her as a monk. I'd been away for so many years. And so that the kind of sense of loving kindness is the sense of non-critical, not being critical, without dismissing the critical mind, accepting or being open to. And that's an attitude which I think is coexistent with right mindfulness, because right mindfulness, if it doesn't have that sense of open-heartedness to the way things are done, I don't think it's really right mindfulness. It can be right control, but or wrong control. It can be controlling. Right? Whereas when awareness is conjoined with the heart, it knows, but it doesn't know in an analytical way. It knows in a way of being receptive and open and attentive. Then to me, that's a very balanced awareness. When awareness is like just some kind of a, like, let's say I'm aware that I'm feeling upset about my dentist. I should have a very good dentist. Actually, I go to a dental hospital in Bangkok, so maybe I shouldn't use dentist. But you get the image. So the image of the dentist comes up into my mind, and then, yeah, this aversion feels this way. And the mind opens to aversion. Or resentment feels this way, it opens. So awareness is not just something which notes, it also accepts, and it opens. So the way I try to train my mind in doing that, I try to train in a sense of being receptive. So you can, again, you can look at me using the critical mind, not critical bad, but just saying, you look at my hand gestures and you think nice hand gestures or weird hand gestures or whatever you think. So you can look at it that way. And you can also look at it into just letting the image come to you, being receptive. Just let it, like just the sitting here, I can look at you, right? And say they're men and women, young, they're old, the wall is gray, the light fixtures are there, da 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 da, the size of the room, or I can just stop and say, receive this room. Receive whatever imagery is there. And that always brings me to silence. Not a silence which is trying to get rid of thought and trying to sort of control things, but rather a silence which just comes from openness and acceptance. So that I can do. One of the ways that Majin Sumedho's taught me, he would say, he uses the word to make conscious. So like, make conscious this situation. And how do you make something conscious? You allow it to come up into consciousness. And to do that, you have to wait. You have to wait. And then sounds, feelings, whatever, become manifest in consciousness. And what I find there is then the object isn't being emphasized. I'm not emphasizing the object of the room or the sound or the people. What I'm emphasizing is the knowing or the awareness. When I look at, say, if I count the number of people in this room, and I look at the gender of the people and so on, then I'm emphasizing the object, right? I'm analyzing. I say, there's 14, there's 14, there's 16 on the side, and how many will we have for lunch, and so on. But when I just allow this situation to arise in consciousness, just to be the way it is, in the waiting, there is silence, and what I'm emphasizing is the knowing. I'm not emphasizing the quality of the experience. If I feel, let's say, someone said it might be hot, we might put on the fans so that I feel the heat. And if I make conscious the very feeling of heat, if heat feels this way, and I wait, I'm emphasizing the knowing of heat. If I then feel very, very hot, and this is too hot, then I emphasize this is too hot, and I put the fans on. So both are okay, both are okay, but I think that receptive part of our experience, I think we're not so trained in that. At least I wasn't. You know, I was always trained through the head, through analysis, through complex intellectual structures, because Buddhism can be, it can be have some very, very complex structures. And so I found that interesting in the beginning, and to some extent, appealing, but then when I came to Wakpapong, Ajahn Chah said, stop reading for 5 years. He said, you know too much. What do you mean? And he said, read this more. And so he encouraged that sense of being conscious, being awake. If you don't have the analytical faculty, you can become very naive. Oh, wonderful dentist. And keep going back to the same dentist. So it's not about being naive or sentimental. It's not about that. It's just these different ways that we as humans can understand life and then respond to life, I think, in a skillful way. So those are that sort of heart-head. I kind of like those ideas. They help me. And so maybe that's the way I'll talk about the meditation. So in terms of meditation, let's say if you're sitting in meditation and let's say you're used to sitting for half an hour, and then I set the clock for 45 minutes. So after 29 minutes, you've been conditioned to stop the meditation because that's what you've been doing at home. So after 29 minutes, what arises is anticipation, the dharma of anticipation, because that's the way the mind has been conditioned. So after 29 minutes, then you begin to think, should I look at my clock or not? Should I shift or not? Anticipation. Now if you are not aware of the anticipation as an object, then you become the subject of anticipation, and you anticipate. You look at the clock, and then if you find me nodding, you get afraid, because you think, he's forgotten to ring the bell, whatever it might be. You now start to be a person in the mode of anticipation, and then you're getting restless, and you think, should I move, should I not move, and now you have become, your analytical mind has become conditioned by anticipation. It's not immoral. It's not, there's nothing wrong with it, but it is still not fully awake, I would say. But if you have the sense of, well, anticipation is an object, it can be known, and you make conscious the very feeling of anticipation, just use that kind of language, anticipation feels this way, then you're emphasizing the knowing rather than your thoughts being driven by the anticipation. Your body might still feel the anticipation, you might feel discomfort because you're not used to sitting 45 minutes, but constantly what you're doing is you're awakening your mind, okay, this is, you're making conscious anticipation, not suppressing it, not getting rid of it, not even making a comment on it, but knowing it, being aware that it's something that has arisen and is changing. And that attitude of non-anticipation of change is in itself non-anticipation, because you know anticipation. You're no longer the subject of anticipation. Now that might not seem like much, but you know, how much do we anticipate in life? How much of anxiety and fear and so on are wrapped up in the same kind of structures of consciousness? So by taking that little exercise of just the end of a sitting and just know, anticipation feels this way, and being the knowing, that's the heart for me. And it's not about, oh, I love anticipation. It's such a nice state of mind. That's sentimentality. That's where people who are cynical get turned off by practices of metta bhavana, because they mistake it for sentimentality. As I was joking on Cortez, the cougars do not lay down with the deer and have a cup of tea. The cougar eats the deer, right? And that idea that, you know, that all of nature is loving, it's pretty fierce. But that's nature. Nature is that way. It has fierceness. It has lovingness in it. So to me, the heart, or metta bhavana, and the word loving, for those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist terminology, metta is usually translated as loving kindness. But that can be a tall order when you're feeling anticipation. But if you make the idea of metta, if you broaden that to that sense of acceptance and openness to the way things are, to dharma, the dharma of anticipation, because anticipation is dharma. It's natural. It arises and it ceases. So if you make that concept broader, without denying the very goodness of using it as loving kindness, but use it broader, then I would say that sense of making conscious anticipation is the heart. The head knows anticipation, and the heart accepts openness. And to me, that's a very balanced way of approaching. And so the emphasis then becomes the knowing of change. And in the knowing of change, you begin to incline towards the unconditioned, the deathless, the transcendent, nirvana, the harbor, the island, peace, the end of suffering. Because you're emphasizing now the awareness rather than the object. Greed, hatred, and delusion emphasize the object. And from that, you become the subject. Huh? So, in a little exercise of knowing anticipation, there's a tremendous teaching, tremendous amount of possibility. So let's stretch your legs a bit, and then we'll sit for 45 minutes and see how those ideas go.